Greenstein, and I am the room host for this session. And we are very fortunate to have Bonnie Jaffe here, who's going to be speaking on caregiving in the home versus facilities. So more about that later, but I just want to kind of touch on a few things. First of all, let everyone know that this session is being recorded, which is why I'm using a microphone right now. If you do have questions, Bonnie will answer questions at any point in time, but we do ask that you talk into this box so that it can be recorded. And all the sessions are being recorded, and people can listen to them online. So if you do have a question, just raise your hand and grab one of the, grab this box. Also, on your way out or at some point during the session, if you want, we do have some handouts that Bonnie has provided. So feel free at any point just to go out and grab those if you would like. After the session, please join us in the sanctuary for the fabulous concert that is pretty impressive. So please join us for that. Let me just introduce Bonnie. Bonnie is a registered nurse with many years of hospital experience prior to joining Jewish Family Service of St. Paul in 2008. In her current position at JFS, Bonnie advocates for best care practices for her care coordination clients to enable them to age in place using appropriate services in the home and community. Bonnie also helps Holocaust survivors and their families access funding from home care services through the Claims Conference, which is the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany. Bonnie is presently working with people that have all forms of dementia. Her daily practice also includes caregiving coaching, family consultations, and leading the JFS Grief and Caregiver Support Groups. She's trained in powerful tools for caregivers, REACH Community for Caregivers, and Dementia Friends. Bonnie has also been trained by Honoring Choices of Minnesota to assist people in completing advanced care directives. So please join me in welcoming Bonnie.
Thanks. Yes, I'm old. So let me just say, I'll introduce myself just a little bit further and say, we all wear different hats, and I'll just tell you some of my hats. So I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother, I have a bunch of crazy grandchildren running around, and then we already discussed the most important part is that I have a mother who is in a facility, a memory care facility in outside of St. Paul. So I had her in my home for a year and a half and took care of her. And then when money started to run out, we decided to place her in a memory care facility. So today I will talk about quality care in the home or in a facility. I'm just going to give you just a brief historical background. Did anybody read the book On Being Mortal by Atal Gawande? So he speaks a lot about this history, and I'm just going to briefly cover it, because it was very interesting when I reread his book a few months ago. So when you were very poor in the early, early years, the places that poor people would go if their families couldn't take care of them would be poorhouses, right, or almshouses. Housing and basic care for the poor and indigent folks, if there was no family to care for them, that was where they went, and care was really poor. Hygiene was terrible. Then we come up to the late 19th and early 20th century, and the United States becomes more industrialized, and care needs increase. So back then, what would happen is church groups, or probably synagogue groups as well, started to take care of their elderly and create home situations. And a lot of times, the communities would also help take care of these folks. In the 1930s, the Great Depression, Social Security Act of 1935, they prohibited federal assistance to residents of poorhouses, and it forced the adults to seek long-term care at private institutions, which I think is interesting. The 1950s, there was an amendment to the Social Security Act in the 1950s and allowed payment for care in licensed public institutions. So there was a rapid growth of nursing homes in the United States at that point. And then in the 1960s, well, from the 1941, there was the Hill-Burton Act, which was a grant to help build nursing homes next to hospitals. So then we sort of shifted from the welfare system to the healthcare system. And in 1965, of course, we got Medicare and access to health insurance for adults 65 and plus, and then new nursing homes set up for future years. Then, in 1981, believe it or not, was the first time that somebody established assisted living in Oregon. This Dr. Karen Wilson, and you can look her up. It's fascinating. And Atul Gawande really talks a lot about that model back then. And we've come a long way since that point. What we've come away with, and I don't know if it's so good, is we have basically the same systems in place, except there's somewhat better systems in place. So we have more choices. Medicare is still in place. We also have, because of Medicare, we have TCU stays, transitional care stays, where people can go after hospitalization, and Medicare will cover the cost of that. Although Medicare is kind of stingy, and they will only cover a little bit of time after somebody comes out of a hospital stay, depending on what the diagnosis. They look at, you know, in the TCUs, how much you're getting better. If you're not getting better, out you go. Also, the other thing is that if you are a person with little means, you're eligible for medical assistance or MA. And then if you're older, you're not only eligible for that, if you're of low income, you're also eligible for the elderly waiver. I'm not going to get into the details of that, but that is something that older people that are at a very low income are eligible for. Now, if you're a person of means, of course, you have to pay for everything. And that means middle income and above. And now our middle income has become so depressed that these are the people that are really suffering, that are really unable to pay for a lot of these services. So, all right. So there's three options for care. So one is caring for a person in the home without any outside help, friends, family, you know, church groups, synagogue groups, you know, that kind of thing. Caring for a person in the home with assistance from a home care agency. And then the last is assisted living, memory care, or nursing home care. So in my practice, in my program, I look at these three things. And some people say, well, we're going to care for the person in our home, and this one and that one is going to help us. And then sometimes people will say to me, well, we want to do that, but we want to hire somebody outside, like not through an agency. So I will cover what that is going to look like if you decide to do that. And then home health agencies next. So let's see what we do here. So how do families make the decision? What's the right fit? So each family, before I go on, has unique needs. You can only determine that. For myself, when my mother lived with me, I was able to take care of her in my home. I had the skill set to be able to do that. I also had a son that helped me out and kids that, you know, came and went and helped. But at the point where she was running out of money, we had to make a decision, and that was when we put her in a memory care. But so each person, each family has something. So, for instance, like in Judaism, we have the norm of kibbutz av aim, you know, honoring our parents. And so we have a financial and a physical obligation to help our parents and take care of them. For instance, in a Hmong community, it's usually the oldest son or the youngest son who will take care of their parent as they age. Although, all of this said, because we are moving ahead, and let's say the Hmong immigrants, Jewish immigrants, there's no more of that so much. People kind of change with the culture that they're surrounded by. So, let's see. All right, consulting your loved one. So, if you're in the home and, you know, it's important to make sure that the loved one is able to participate in decision-making, to be sure to include them if they are able to make those decisions about home care agencies, if you're bringing a home care agency in. If, when we go down the line, even have them interview. When you bring home care agencies in to look and see what they're like, if your loved one can help and interview them, so be it. It's great. So one of the things that I really thought about was when my mother was in my home, I had to look at these factors. Look at how your loved one's home is situated, or your own home if you're bringing them into your home. Okay? Sometimes there's stairs, but we can accommodate those needs with equipment. So if there are stairs, for instance, maybe you need a stair lift. And the stair lift, it's not cheap, but you could put that in so that the person can access, let's say, a bathroom on the second floor or a bedroom. So it might not be such an impossible situation. Are they in their own room or home or in your home? So you have to think about where are they? What parts of the home will the caregiver need to access? Will they need to be in your kitchen? Will they need to be? Where will they be? You know, I have a client now who, they live in a townhouse, and he doesn't want the caregivers to follow him up and down the steps, even though he's a huge fall risk, right? So, you know, you have to weigh safety and weigh people's needs as well. Also, I always recommend to plan out a daily schedule, you know, for the aides to know, or for your relatives to know what does this person need every day. And I always also found that the more regular you can create a schedule for your loved one, the better off, especially if they have some sort of dementia. Very important. Regular, you know, they need to know that at 8 o'clock they're eating breakfast. I mean, that's just a given. All right. So what are your priorities of care? How do you see the day unfolding? Develop a care plan, which is, you know, all the things I basically said. Every home care agency will have a care plan. And you should be the one to really add to that care plan and say what you want and need for your loved one and for yourself. Because remember, they might be in your home. So you need to do that. I work with an agency, and I'm very fussy with my clients because I want the best care for my clients, just like you'd want the best care for your loved one. And so my agency that I work with closely knows this is what I want. And I add my own, you know, my own care plan to their existing care plan. So, and it's especially, like I said, important with dementia. Remember, a home care agency is going to be taking care of all kinds of people, not just people with dementia. So, all right, more things to consider. Know your tolerance level. When others are in the home, do you really need to be there? Do you trust the caregiver to be alone? Sometimes we don't know what triggers us until it happens. This can happen with caregivers in the home. Pay attention to your own reactions as well as those of your loved one to determine what works and what doesn't work. So an example is I had a particular caregiver in my home, and my mother is the most non-judgmental person in the world. She's always smiling. And I came home one day from work, and she said, "She is not a nice person." And I was like, ooh. So that was it, because my mother is not a complainer. And I was like, and then another caregiver I had came and was proselytizing to my son. So I was like, ooh. And I share that with the home care agency so that they know this is not a caregiver that I don't only not want in my home with my loved one, but please don't send them to my client's home either. So just, you know, to be clear. Home options for people with dementia without paid assistance. Safety. So safety is the most important thing. Can they be safe in their home or in yours? Okay. So these are questions you want to ask yourself. Can they carry out all ADLs, activities of daily living, without any help? Okay. Can they carry out some ADLs? Time and patience required for the family caregiver. So look at this. The ADLs are, does anybody know what the ADLs are? Bathing, dressing, all the stuff there, toileting, eating, transferring in and out of bed and chair. And then the IADLs are a little bit, we can cover for them a little bit better. So it's like shopping, cooking, housekeeping, setting up and managing medications, managing finances, and using transportation. So the ADLs are the most important thing. So if they can't do a lot of those ADLs, who is doing them? So is it you? Now, coming back to the place of some people come to me and say, look, I want to hire my own caregiver, right? That's fine. But my husband used to say a famous phrase, and it's so true. If it's too cheap, I can't afford it, right? So they want to hire somebody for $15 an hour, $10 an hour. That's great. A, you can find, you might be able to find them. But B, how reliable are they? And they have nobody that they're answering to except you. No background check. There's no agency. I did have one client once who was with the agency that I use primarily. And there was an aide in that situation that was stealing. We got wind of it, and it never happened again with any of this agency, but they got rid of that aide. They prosecuted her, and the home care company has insurance to back them up to pay that money back. So I'm just saying it's risky, you know, when you really don't know somebody and you're just taking risks. And it depends on what, if you're risk adverse or not. So, home options for people with dementia working with a home health care agency. So how do we choose an agency? So we want an agency that understands the needs and personality of the client. In my case, when I work with a client, the agency has to understand my needs too as the care manager because I have certain expectations. Communication process, can you communicate well with them? What does that look like? And I recommend you interview at least three home care agencies before you decide which one you really like the best. Staffing issues. Staffing issues are always issues in a home care agency, in a facility. It doesn't matter where we go, in a hospital. Since COVID, staffing is down. So keep your expectations a little bit at bay, because we all want the best, but it doesn't necessarily happen. How well can the aides or the agency actually work with the family that's hiring, okay? Is cost and paperwork clear? So when an agency comes to you with the paperwork, make sure that everything is really clear. Sometimes they ask for 2 weeks up front. Ask them what that's for. Does that go into a fund so that you can pull it back after the person is not? Do you have to give them a certain number of days before you tell them we're done with your agency? So those are important details so you don't get charged a crazy amount. This is the typical cost for home care, $40 to $50 for private pay. There's usually a minimum number of hours that agencies will send a caregiver out. That's usually about 3 hours a shift. There are some agencies that I've encountered that want 4 hours a shift, and they will only minimally send out somebody if you hire them for 12 hours a week. So it really, it's a big range. Okay, so we talked a little bit about in the home. Anybody have questions about what to do in the home? Or I'm all ears. Wait.
Just about the case that you mentioned where there was an aide that was stealing from the home. How did they find out? How did they track that? And what led to a successful prosecution?
So I found out that the aide was stealing from the family. And then I went to the home care agency and I said, this is a huge issue. I don't want the aide in the home anymore. And then they turned it over to the police. And then they filed the claim for insurance to reimburse the family. And it was crazy things, too. It wasn't just money. There was some cash. But she was like stealing clothes. It was crazy. So it's kind of interesting what people will take.
Did they require some kind of proof to document that there was theft? Or did they take the word?
I don't know how the police necessarily handled it. The agency took it seriously. There was no questions. It happened to be that same agency I used for my own mother. And I had told the aide that I have a small dog. And I said to the aide, don't ever let my dog out the front door. So what happens? I come home one day from work. She sees that I'm coming, you know, up the drive, and she opens the door and lets the dog out. The dog rips its, I forget, rotator cuff or whatever. It was like a $4,000 surgery. I'm like, hello. And so insurance paid for that surgery. So, I mean, this happens to be, to me, an exceptional company, and that's why I work with them. So what does facility level of care mean? When a person can no longer safely remain in their home, it might be time to look at facilities that offer care for seniors. So if you can think about, what would you think? When would you think a person is unsafe in their home? Tell me some scenarios. Or, go ahead.
They're falling down the stairs.
Here, wait, say it again.
When they're falling down the stairs or they're flooding the bathroom. We had issues with my sister-in-law, and then we decided we had to move her out of a place we had bought for her to live, and okay. She moved into assisted living.
Okay. Anybody else?
When they start wandering.
Okay. Anybody else? Don't be shy.
When they won't stop driving.
Okay. Those are really, really good examples. And I have a client right now who's an early onset Alzheimer's person, and he has a home. He's not a wanderer. He doesn't flood things, but he also, his hygiene I have seen is taking a big dip. Okay. He's not hurting anybody by that, right? Because it's him that might not smell so good, but it doesn't really affect him. However, his dental health is really bad, so it leads him to have issues where he gets toothaches and has to have teeth pulled. That is true. But if you put somebody like that with that type of issue, where let's say they're not taking care of them, their physical health, their physical body and their teeth and their showering, we can take that person and put them in a facility and they still won't do it. Because in a facility, they cannot force anybody to do any of these things, right? But what's unsafe with him, I find, nothing that much except I set up a medication machine for him for 2 weeks. When I see 5 doses missing, that's a trigger for me, because then he's not getting the proper medication. And if I see behavioral changes, that also, which I have. That's not the thing, though, that really would tip me off. The one thing I told his family is, if I see that he can no longer warm up or put his food in a microwave safely, we're done.
And the family's very resistant to putting him in a facility. I understand it. This man loves his home. But if he can't feed himself at the end of the day, that's what I'm really, really worried about. That's just one case. Okay. So how do we choose the right facility? This is long. So staff try their best, and hopefully there's enough staff to care for clients. Since COVID, like I said before, there's been a decline in staff wanting to work in healthcare. It's just the way it is. People would rather go into other areas to work and not have to have lower pay and sometimes kind of crummy conditions. The positive part of the facility is that they can pull help from other units if there's a shortage of staff. In the home, this is not always possible with staff from an agency. I've butt up against it with my mother, with clients. You know, I'll say, wait, where's the aide? And they'll say, well, we don't have anybody. One agency made me wait like an hour and a half for an aide to come. I said, this person can't be alone. And I said to the person who owned the company, I said, I suggest you get over there and you be with my client until your aide can get there. They were very put off by that. But who's going to take care of somebody that's very at risk? So that's another thing to look for in an agency. Are the owners really willing to go the extra mile? I look at that. Families are allowed to place cameras in the room of your loved one to track their care. There's a state of Minnesota form that needs to be filled out, but everybody in a facility can have a camera. My own mother has a camera in her room, and I make sure that I check it several times a day. I have sisters in Philadelphia that check it. I mean, everybody's checking it. But I have to also tell my sisters, give some grace. You know, like, we don't always know circumstances. My mother was a great one for the bed would be all the way to the bottom, and she would crawl out. So that used to set my two sisters, crazy.
And pick your battles.
And pick your battles, of course. Discuss with the aides caring for your loved one what they were like when they were younger. Hobbies, decorate the room with the things that will remind them of their achievements, anything. Just do everything you want in that room, in that space, to connect them. I think it's really important. Activities and facilities are usually available at least twice a day. Encourage loved ones to attend and attend with them. If your loved one is in memory care, they might not always be able to go to activities like outside of the memory care unit, but sometimes they can. I learned a lot for the facility. The facility my mother is in, she has excellent caregivers, but their activities, not so much. You know, so keep in mind what you want for your loved one. If you want really good, stellar activities, be there during the day when they have activities. Go to the activities when you're checking out the facility. Go to activities after dinner. See what's going on in the evening as well. So, check the facility to see if you have a volunteer, that the volunteer can go and visit your loved one or take your loved one out. You get to decide that as well. All right, there's five types of care. Many of you, does everybody know these models a little bit? Independent, senior living, assisted living. By the way, memory care in Minnesota comes under the umbrella of assisted living. So just know that. Nursing home, which is also, you know, people will say, they'll interchangeably say nursing home or skilled nursing facility. And then a group home setting. So independent senior living means being as self-sufficient as possible. And the person can take as many risks as they want. Let's say you have a person who's a fall risk, but they're really independent. They're fine. And they decide they're not going to use their walker. What can you do? They are of sound mind and body, and they can make those decisions. And if they go into the hospital, so be it. That's their decision. That's what independent living means. Being able to exercise the utmost amount over what you do and who you are in the world. So, Assisted living, residential senior living, in addition to providing safe, engaging, and vibrant lifestyle, offers personalized help with activities of daily living. Okay? Keep in mind, this is not there to prevent falls. They're going to fall wherever they are. I don't mean to be a downer, but if you're thinking, I'm going to move my person, my loved one, into a facility because they're falling all the time. My mother must have fallen 12 times in my house. I'm a nurse, right? I don't feel any shame. People are impulsive, and they do what's normal to them. And sometimes I could pick her up, and sometimes I had to call 911. Wait. Let me just get this to you.
Although when you're there to see that they fall and you're there to help, it's different than if they lived alone.
That is true.
Yeah, so when they're living alone and falling, then they don't have someone to help them immediately.
Do they have a health alert system? Do you know what a health alert system is?
A lot of them don't want to wear them.
I understand that. I get it. I do. I mean, I advocate strongly for health alert systems. And, you know, sometimes that's something you can bargain with an older adult and say, look, we want you to live here as long as you can. But this is a requirement because it'll keep you safe and it'll keep me sane. Uh-huh. If you can say it.
Yeah.
You know. Next one is assisted living memory care. So it's sort of like assisted living on steroids, so to speak. There's staff around all the time. Supposedly there's more staff. Yes and no. I'm not so sure about that. But the model is it offers a more specialized form of assisted living to meet the needs of people with dementia. So, nursing home, skilled care. A nursing home is a place for people who don't need to be in a hospital but can't be cared for at home. They usually have 24/7 nurses, their LPNs or RNs. So why not put a person with dementia in a nursing home instead of putting them in a memory care? Anybody have any thoughts about that?
I would say lack of planned activities and structure to the day, for one thing. The other thing that I found with transitional care, so maybe it's related to this, is in spite of that, no one is there to help if your loved one has fall risks. You have to still bring somebody in from the outside, and then there's legal issues with that, whether they'll let them in. So that's a complicated piece of that for me.
That is complicated. And I guess the activity part that you mentioned is really important, because in memory care, they're supposed to have really planned activity. And the other thing about a skilled nursing facility, so like let's say I have somebody with dementia, but they have huge bed sores. What would be the proper placement for them? Anybody? Nursing home. Right, nursing home. Because a nursing home has the skilled help to take care of those wounds every day. And some nursing homes, of course, are set up like hospitals. Okay, group homes. The term group home means a single family residence, and sometimes they have like 8 people and they have 8 different bedrooms or 6 different bedrooms. These are common in the waivered world, so a lot of times people that are on medical assistance or they have a mental health issue will go into group homes. Group homes sort of replaced in the 1960s or 70s, early 70s. They replaced the state hospitals. Anybody remember the state hospitals? This replaced it. So it's not to say that we couldn't put our loved one in a group home, but, you know, that's what a group home is. Continuing care retirement communities. So a community offers independent living, and then they go to each level, assisted living, memory care, skilled nursing, rehab. We have some of them in the Twin Cities, but not a lot that has every single piece of that. Okay, first, these are just suggestions. Ask friends and family for recommendations for facilities.
Explore facilities in advance. Remember to, like I said, tour in the day and the evening. And I know you don't feel bad to drive these people crazy and say, I want to come at 4 o'clock when the evening shift is there. You know, people that the people that will tour you through, they could do a tour at 4:30 when evening is there. So you want to see what's going on then. Explore multiple facilities. Be straightforward in discussing costs. There could be a lot of hidden costs in facilities. Typical cost for memory care, $10,000. Okay? Typical. There could be a little bit less, a little bit more. Assisted living can be about $4,000 to $8,000, a little bit less, a little bit more. I'm just giving you a range. And with the assisted living, be careful because let's say your loved one is the kind of person, they have some memory loss, but it's mild, but they won't really go down to the dining room, right? So then you're going to need somebody to escort them. Well, an escort costs 15 minutes there and 15 minutes back, and they charge a certain amount. So be careful of those little hidden costs. Make sure that you calculate all that. Look at the activities, which I said before. Post-COVID, I talked about that it's, you know, fewer people willing to work in this area. Thank God, I say, for immigrant populations that are here to help our loved ones. And I don't want to say anything political. But anyway, thank God. Okay? Thank God. Because, you know, my grandparents came here from the Ukraine, and they did the most menial jobs. They worked in a luggage factory, a hat factory. But they thrived, and so are many of our immigrant populations thriving. You know, people that came in the 90s and the, you know, early 2000s and the 80s, so whatever. Anyway, as consumers, our expectations are usually very high. We want the best for our loved ones. And keep that standard because it's important. And look at the leadership. Look at the directress of nursing. Look at the executive director. What's their philosophy? Are they in line with what you want? Because if you're not in line with them, that might not be the facility for you. Okay? Care is expensive. There, you know, it was on the last slide. People with dementia cannot accurately report problems or issues with the care they receive. We are their advocates. Now, how much do you listen to? How much do you? It depends on your family member, and it depends on how their dementia is presenting. You know, so that can be a tricky one. That could be a tricky area. I know personally for my mother, she never complains. So when she complains, listen. Financial realities. Do they charge extra for night supervision? These are just a few things. Do they only take private payment? This is a big one. Will they accept waiver payments, caddy or elderly waiver? Ask a facility, will they take the waiver if the client runs out of money? A lot of facilities will not take a waiver. They want the person to be in the facility for 2 years, 24 months, paying that $100,000. So when I work with people and I do care planning with people and it's about a money, I always ask people, I'm not trying to be nosy, but do you have this kind of money? What do you have? And because that will help facilitate the right timing for you to have the person go into a facility. If my mother did not have so little money at the end, I would have never put her in a facility. But that's just me. But the reality was that it was time and the money was of the essence. So, does the person have long-term care insurance? So long-term care insurance will pay for, but by the way, they love to take our money.
they'd hate to pay us. So that is a huge battle sometimes. So if you know that somebody's going into a facility, let's say they have a hospitalization and then they're in a TCU and you know that they're going to go into a facility after the TCU, start the clock. Call that long-term care. Start the clock ticking because they'll cover the TCU stay, and then that's when the clock. A lot of times with long-term care, it's a 90-day wait period. They make you wait. So start it as soon as you can. Please wait. Let me just give you this. Just put it up close to your.
Just put the exclamation point on that. My husband had a surgery and he came home and he was having trouble, and when I called our long-term care insurance policy, thank God that we had one. They said, well, you got to start this right away if you're going to have in-home care. And as it turned out, we got through the little crises. But then as things have gotten complicated, he's just going to a day program 2 days a week. And we started the clock immediately because I knew that. So he's on day 40 or whatever. So there, we have to pay the first 90 days. And it's for a day program, what, $90 a day or whatever it is?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't care, because when he gets to long-term care, it's going to be, you know, 10 to 13 grand a month.
Mm-hmm.
And the insurance company, as long as I've paid for 90 days of day program, they will kick in.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, that's really good advice. Yes. And then what can you and your loved one actually afford? So if you're in that situation where your person is running out of money, I'm just going to say that they have to have $3,000 or less to be eligible for medical assistance and to get an elderly waiver. It's very strange and it's very difficult, but I like to tell people when they get down to their last $10,000, start really monitoring. And even when they're at $5,000, you can apply for medical assistance. They might reject you, but then the clock starts with medical assistance. So they'll look at your medical assistance from the time that you start the clock. And that's really important. Working with a home care agency or facility, so respect for care standards. There are standards in the state of Minnesota. So you can look them up for agencies, for facilities, and you can see what those standards are. Everyone's concern is important, and the care recipient's concern, like, really matters the most. And if they can't speak for themselves, then you're speaking for them. I think I went over some of this, taking tours during the day, request a tour at shift change during the evening, look online to see reviews, right? Comments, compare costs for each facility, talk to staff on the unit, use your senses. I walked into a facility recently and I took somebody and the person was touring us, but I saw aides sitting there, like in the kitchen area. They didn't say hello. They just were sitting there. And I was like, they are not engaged, okay? So look at little red flags. Don't ignore them. Write them down so that they're in front of you. Look at the floor plan to make sure a loved one will be comfortable. Look at amenities at each facility, what comes in the package and what has extra charges, programming and activities. Training. Ask the directors of nursing what the training, what's the training? I have this. I can also send this to you all, whoever wants a copy of this. Yes. I'm happy to. Program and activities. Ask about caregiver training and staff ratio. I know in my mother's facility, it's in the evening. And even in the day, it's 1 to 6. I'm not happy about it, but that's the way it is. They do a decent job, though, because I've seen people that are there for years already. She's been there almost 2 years, and it's amazing. They take really good care of the clients. background checks for all staff? Is that happening? And ask about the camera and ask about volunteers. Can they come in? And ask about, you talked about, what did you say about staff?
Well, about having paid care because of staff. And that was in transitional care.
Okay.
Staff was not covering and you've experienced falls.
Right. So, you know, in facilities, they can, you can bring, you should be able to bring your own caregivers in. So, like, recently it was Passover for me, and I couldn't go to see my mother at a certain point, and I had a caregiver come and be with her for two shifts when I couldn't be there. And that was fine with this particular facility. Most facilities are okay with it. You just have to let them know and be in good communication with them. Does the facility have an RN LPN on 24/7 or just on call over the weekends? This is a really tricky one because the facility that my mother is in has the nurse who's the directress of nursing is the one that's on call mostly. And one, my mother happens to be on hospice as well. And at one point she needed an antihistamine. Her allergies were just really bad. So hospice came and got an order from the doctor, and then the doctor said, you know, get her the antihistamine today. So the hospice orders the antihistamine and then called the nurse, and she said, well, I'm not coming in for that. And I'm like, I might be old, but that's kind of a weird thing to say. When a doctor gives an order, you follow through with it. And she said something to me like, you just don't respect my time. I'm like, okay, you're right. And guess what? Don't ever talk to me again. And so I only deal with the executive director. Don't feel afraid to push back. Don't feel afraid. Nothing is going to happen to your loved one. Seriously. So I don't, you know, I'm cordial. And if I have a client, which I do have two clients in her facility because it's a good facility, I email whatever I need to email, and I don't speak to her about anything personal with my mother. It works. Who is on site? Who's the medical provider? So, like, at my mother's facility, we have Bluestone. So you can choose. You can choose to have your loved one use the doctors who are there, or you could take your loved one out for appointments. Some of my clients that live in this particular facility, I actually take them out to their providers because that was their choice. They wanted to go out to their providers. So that's great. Usually at the beginning, when you ask for assisted living or memory care, the nurse will do an assessment. So a lot of times we think that, oh, our mother or our father, they're not that bad. Their dementia's not that bad. But at the end of the day, that nurse is going to make that determination. And sometimes we can get away with it for a little bit of time. I have a new client that we put in assisted living at this facility that they said they would take her in assisted living. But now we're like a month in, and already the facility is coming back to me and saying, what? Like, she needs memory care. And I'm like, what was your assessment like? Why are you telling me this now? I could have told you that. But they didn't, you know, they didn't do their due diligence. Maybe they wanted to fill a bed. So then what happens is you're ending up paying the higher cost anyway, because maybe they only will exist in assisted living for a few months. But maybe truly they decline once they go into a facility. This person was already declining, and it was clear that she needed, you know, a memory care. Make sure they have a written care of plan. Families should be able to develop the plan with the facility. And by the way, I say to you, after your loved one is in a facility for at least, I would say, a month, ask for a care planning meeting. Okay? No matter how much you're in touch with the aides or whatever, ask for a care planning meeting. It's really important. Is there that ability to have a care conference? You know, some, like my facility where my mother is, they've never offered a care conference. I don't personally need it because I see what's going on and I know the ins and outs of it. But, right, exactly. So I think it's important. Are there additional services available on site, such as PT, OT, hospice care? Okay. Now, my mother is on hospice, and when I went to ask the directress of nursing, like, I'm going to bring in this hospice agency, she was like, oh, but we really like this hospice agency. I said, oh, really? I said, well, I like this one, so we're bringing this one in. And she's none too happy about it. But I feel like they will advocate properly for my mother's care. Is transportation available in the community? Doctor's appointments. You know, a lot of facilities, yes, a lot of facilities, no. If you have dealing with a person with dementia, with my mother or my clients, I would never send them on Metro Mobility. I wouldn't send them into the community without somebody watching over. They're too vulnerable. So any reason that a client would need to move to a higher level of care and out of the current home. Okay, so that's, we're talking about dementia mostly, how dementia can change. So quality care is in the eyes of the beholder, and this is what it means, according to Webster. Tell me, what's your questions?
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
So one of the questions that I have versus facility versus in-home is that when someone with dementia, when they progress for a while, they develop behavior problems with aggression and stuff.
Sometimes.
If you have that in the facility will put you on medication to control the behaviors. And what's upsetting to me is if you don't want your loved one on the medication to control the behaviors, then that's the flip side of it. Because the facility is going to put them on medication, correct?
Well, does the loved one use the doctors in that facility? Do you know what I'm saying? Do you take the loved one out?
No, my mom still lives at home.
Oh, she lives at home.
Yes.
Okay, so if behaviors are they're a pretty huge issue. Not always, but sometimes with frontotemporal lobe, Lewy body dementias, there's sometimes a lot of behaviors with that. You ask a really great question. There's no great answer. I've had people in the past. I had a client who went into a psych unit because the behaviors were, and I begged the staff at the memory care not to put him in this. I went crazy. I did activities, and I showed the staff how to do activities with my client that would calm him and, you know. But, you know, honestly, I'm not there 24/7. I don't have the same stresses, and I don't see the same thing that all the staff sees. And at one point, finally, they said to me, we can't do it. And so he went into a psych, Jerry psych unit, and he was given medication. And it was very heartbreaking, but he needed it. And, you know, you can talk to them and say, what's the dose? And I want one thing and a really tiny little bit to see if it helps. I mean, I'm a big believer as a nurse you never change two things at once. One thing at a time. Let me see how it works. Low dose, let's see how it works.
I kind of want to build on that question. We live with my dad at the house, and actually I'm lucky because he's in pretty great shape. Do you have any of the stats on, and if you don't, I know I can look them up, but we're talking about this, how living in the home, it's consistent, the constancy is key, he's happy, he's relatively safe. Mm-hmm. What are the stats on the benefits of living at home?
I don't have stats. Yeah. I don't have stats on that. I mean, look, my practice is for my program that I work with clients, and a lot of them have dementia. I want to keep them in their home until it's absolutely not safe anymore. Because home is the best. It's the best. But when it becomes, I mean, and sometimes people could keep their loved one at home the entire time until death. That would be the most ideal. But sometimes, depending on how things progress, that can take a village. I mean, my husband passed away 7 years ago, but he had cancer. And it took a village of all five of my children coming and helping and taking shifts, right? It wasn't sustainable. It was for 6 months. And, I mean, it was sustainable because I had a village of people. If I would have had to pay caregivers, that would have been quite costly. By the way, the other thing I want to just say, keeping your loved one at home is the best. But if you're going to use caregivers, remember, $40 to $50. Add that up. It's much more expensive than a facility level of care. And I, you know,
yeah, okay. I, mean,
I don't know this.
For me when I,
yeah.
We've got time for one more question.
Okay.
I just wanted to follow up on the conversation about starting a medication for behaviors. I think that it's very important before starting that a target symptom is identified, that it's you decide ahead of time what specific symptom are we targeting, so that that's the basis in which you evaluate whether it's working. And then regarding the getting outside care services, you know, I see a lot of people where the caregivers try to do everything as long as they can because they can because they made some kind of commitment, and they're burning out, mm-hmm. and the relationship, the spouse or child relationship, gets lost. And so I encourage people to consider getting professional services. Maybe it's something that they could do, but if there are some fewer things that they have to do, then they can maybe have an easier time maintaining their
emotion. Can you tell people what you do?
Oh, yeah. So I'm a physician at the VA. I direct this Geriatric Research Education Clinical Center. We have a memory clinic. We have like a three-part mission. So we're responsible for geriatric education for clinical staff and trainees in the VA in this region, and then development, implementation, evaluation of models of geriatric care, and then geriatric research.
Yay! Thank you for that contribution. I just want to say one last thing, and then we're done. Does anybody else have questions first? Okay, I just want to say one last thing. Being in this field for so long has really given me a lot of thought to pre-planning. I'm not 20 anymore, and as we age and we see people, you know, becoming more diminished, it's a great idea to pre-plan and know what you're looking at and put money away or do whatever you have to do to plan for what might or might not occur. So if you haven't been to an elder lawyer to look at your family's finances, go to an elder care lawyer because they really will lead you down the right path. You know, create a will, create advance directives, do all of those pieces to put in safety nets. Thank you so much. Can I do one thing? Can everybody just go around and tell me who you are and who you're caring for? It'll take 1 second. What's your name?
David.
And who are you caring for?
My mother.
At home.
Kathy, my dad at home.
Okay.
I have a sister-in-law that's raised by a car at 18. She's 65 now. She's now in a group home.
Okay.
And so we have gone through the whole gamut of everything with her, plus many others in my life.
Okay.
I'm Steph. I care for my mom at home.
Okay.
I'm Bonnie, and I'm caring for my husband, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at 97.
Okay.
Katrina, I care for my mom. She's 70 with Alzheimer's.
Okay.
Leslie, I care for my mom previously at home. She's now in a TCU, and we're at the...
Going to a facility. Okay.
Patty, my husband has Alzheimer's. This is my first time coming out and talking with other people about it.
Okay.
Well,
professionally, I already said, but you know, when my grandparents were older, my mom created. We had a schedule where every day a different family member would, you know, cover shifts and then eventual overnight shifts. And then my dad used to be the director of St. Paul Jewish Family Services.
Yay!
I'm Beth. My husband Jeff. He lives at home.
Okay, and wait, two other people. Thank you so much, everybody. I loved your contributions. Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
And also, there's handouts right here.
Please get the handouts. Also, there is an evaluation form that we ask you to fill out. And then finally, please join us in the sanctuary. The giving chorus.
JFS has one. I have one.
Incredibly moving.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is it over video or? I was just wondering.